From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
You know, you'd wake up the day before in the morning, and there was Grandma already in the kitchen. You just get the smells, the aromas of the garlic and the citrus from the mojo, and, you know, and it was just kind of ingrained in the memory of sitting there with my grandma while she was preparing it and just talking. And
this week on the show, we dive into a family recipe from Cuba with producer Alexis Carvajal. And producer Daniela Richardson reviews the critically acclaimed show all about kitchen culture, The Bear. Plus, are you wondering what to bring to your solar eclipse viewing picnic? We've got ideas and an original recipe for some special eclipse cookies. All that and more is just ahead, so stay with us. Earth Eats producer Alexis Carvajal grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, but her family's roots on her dad's side reach back to Cuba. She recently set out to learn how to make a traditional family meal, and she put together this story.
Food is one of the strongest ties to our culture. For most families, there's a recipe that's been passed down through generations, a recipe that's made its way from one country to another against all odds. My grandma immigrated to the U.S. from Cuba when she was young, and with her came a recipe steeped in family tradition. Pernil is a slow-roasted pork shoulder dish that's typically made during Noche Buena, Christmas Eve, or any time you have your whole family gathered together. Although I've never had a family gathering with my dad's side, I knew I wanted to learn this recipe. I may have never been to Cuba or sat at a table with my ancestors, but I can cook the same food they have enjoyed. And I can make that meal with the help of my family. It is a recipe I'm going to be preparing with my dad. A recipe that's traveled from Cuba to New Jersey to Florida and now to a tiny kitchen in Fort Wayne, Indiana. But neither me nor my dad had ever made pernil before. So I called up my grandma, she lives in Florida, and asked her how to make pernil. Turns out, the process takes 2 days and 5 hours.
The first thing you do is you salt it all over. And then you're going to prepare a mixture. You can do the blender, pulse 3 or 4 times. And that mixture is going to be cumin, a lot of cumin. Black pepper also is very important. To mix it with all the stuff you're going to put in, you're going to need a little bit of olive oil and 2 bunches of green onions and 1 bunch of cilantro. This next item I always have in my cupboard because I use it all the time, and it's called sazón Goya. It comes with or without azafrán, but you want the one with the azafrán, and you're going to be using 2 packages.
Sazón Goya is a seasoning which contains garlic, cumin, salt, and turmeric, and importantly, azafrán, which means saffron. Once we had the mixture blended, it was time to prepare the marinade for the pernil.
And also for the mojo, which is the liquid, to marinate it too. It's called Goya Marinade.
Mojo criollo, or mojo for short, is a staple of Cuban cuisine. It's made from the juice of sour oranges and lime, garlic, oregano, cumin, salt, and pepper. You can make it from scratch if you're feeling ambitious, or you can buy it from the store. The word criollo refers back to Spaniards who settled in Latin America and their descendants. A lot of Cuban cuisine has Spanish roots, like a lot of Cubans do, but with the added Cuban flair.
Right now, the garlic aroma is very strong.
Very.
That's garlic and a bit of citrus from the mojo, definitely.
Yep. Yeah, the sour orange. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was a kid, Grandma used to make it from scratch. We didn't buy it in the mojo part. Because we had a sour orange tree, the citrus base of mojo is actually sour orange. Mm-hmm. It's not lemon, which makes a pretty big difference when you're cooking with it. But we had a sour orange tree in the backyard, and Grandma would go out there, pick however many sour oranges she needed, 5 or 6 or whatever, go inside and make the mojo dead from scratch with just the all the seasonings and the garlic and the sour orange juice.
Is there a little bit of lime juice in it as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But most of it is a sour orange, which is important in the use because it's sour, but it doesn't have the same, it's just a different sourness, a different sour flavor profile than what a lemon would give. The sour orange is a little bit more subtle.
Now that we had the mixture and our marinade prepared, we had to prep the meat.
And then you're going to make slits on the burnie, but you don't want to pierce it all the way down. You go halfway. And so in those slits, after you have the mix that you blended in the blender, you're going to fill it. Just put a whole bunch of them in all those holes. And then after that, you're going to also rub it all over the burnie outside. You're going to rub. Get Reynolds Kitchen oven bag and look for the size that says turkey. And that's the one you want. After you did all that, you're going to put it in that bag.
So what I'm doing now is something that, if memory serves correct, my grandma used to do. She used to use bigger pieces of garlic, like I'm doing, to actually cap the holes in the meat where you put the marinade. So, okay.
Perfect.
So we're good. We'll wrap her up and...
Yep, put the mojo in and then...
And once it is in the bag, then you're going to pour the rest of the Goya marinade mojo criollo inside that bag. And you're going to tie it good. And you're going to leave it in the refrigerator for 48 hours.
With that, we could leave the pernil until it was finally time to cook it.
Now, the cooking time, it says to cook it for 350 and use 30 minutes per pound. And then when it's cooking, once in a while, like let's say an hour and a half goes by, you take a look at it. And then at the end, after the 3 hours, if you still see that you want it more crispy, you know, then you let it, depends on how crispy you want it. Just don't let it get burned. Thinking about it already, I'm hungry.
Since pernil takes 5 hours to cook, you can prepare some of your side dishes while you wait.
So what do you typically serve with it?
Rice. Could be any kind of rice you want. If white rice is what we usually eat. We also have the beans. The Cubans usually use a lot of black beans. There's different kinds of ways to make the beans from scratch. And that comes like from Spain. My grandma used to be able to do those, and I love them. And besides that, you can also make tostones.
Tostones are fried plantains and one of my absolute favorites. They're perfectly crispy on the outside and just a little bit softer on the inside. I've only ever ordered them in restaurants, but making them is actually pretty easy.
To prepare those, you cut the ends and then with the point of the knife from one end to the other, you try to slice down and then just by going back and forth with knife at one point, you'll be able to just with your hand peel them that way. And then after you got that, I usually cut it maybe an inch. Or less than an inch, but you cut it in pieces. And then you're going to, if you don't have a plantain smasher, you can also do it with the back of a glass. But first you fry it in chunks like that. You make the oil, it's got to be very hot.
Yeah.
You put them in. And when you put them in, they're like, you know, not cooked. So they look more like pinkish or something like that. To know that they're cooked, they got to be yellow. When they turn yellow and you see the consistency, you take them out. That's when you're going to smash them. One by one, you smash it down. Once they're smashed, then you have to put them back in into that hot oil, but not for long. You can tell more or less how crispy you want them, and then you take them out, and at that point, they're cooked, and just salt them. I love those.
By the time the tostones were perfectly fried, our rice and beans were done. Now that we had finished combining all those flavors, it was finally time to taste the fruits of our labor.
All right.
All right, moment of truth. Let's see what we got here.
Time for the taste test.
All right, looking pretty good. Get her out of the oven here. All right. Oh, that smells proper.
Yeah?
Yeah, that smells like my childhood.
Oh, that's good.
Let's see. Let's taste test it, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
See? Yeah, we definitely got the flavor right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good texture. We definitely got the citrusy. Yeah. Yeah, we got it. I don't know that it's quite up to the caliber of grandma's, but it's pretty good. It's not bad. Yeah, here, try some.
Okay.
Mmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, the rub's really good.
Okay. So we'll grab our rice and our tostones, mm-hmm. and we'll be good to go.
But it's not just about the amazing taste of the pernil. Since it's such an old recipe, there's many precious memories that come with this meal.
What is your fondest memory surrounding pernil?
Probably in Cuba when I was still little and we would go to the country. That's where most of my grandma's family lived. There would be like more than 20 people gathered together.
I can just remember like being a little kid and always being excited whenever my grandma made this. Because it was the process. You know, you'd wake up the day before in the morning and there was grandma already in the kitchen. You know, granted, this was a big family we had. We had 7 people living in this house. So it was a big pig. You know, it wasn't the whole pig, but it was a big pernil. So she had to start that prep early. So, you know, you'd go in the kitchen and you'd just get the smells, the aromas of the garlic and the citrus from the mojo. And, you know, and it was just kind of ingrained in the memory of sitting there with my grandma while she was preparing it and just talking. And those were, I guess it was kind of something I associate with my family.
And to me, this is the real power of food. Not just the flavors on your tongue, but the memories that flood your mind with that first bite. And of course, the moments you share with the people you love. For Earth Eats, I'm Alexis Carvajal. You can find this recipe on our website, eartheats.org.
Alexis Carvajal is a producer on our show. Coming up after a short break, ideas on what to serve for your solar eclipse viewing party. Stay with us. Kate Young here. This is Earth Eats. The total solar eclipse is happening in a few short days. And where we are located in Bloomington, Indiana, is directly in the path of totality. This means that for about 4 minutes, our view of the sun will be completely covered by the moon. It is a rare and spectacular event, expected to draw huge crowds to locations along the path of totality. In 2017, actually the day before I started as host of Earth Eats, I traveled down to Kentucky to witness a total eclipse. We gathered with a few other people in a public park outside of a small town, and naturally, we had a picnic while we waited. Which brings me to the burning question on everyone's mind right now. What to eat for the eclipse? Never fear, I've got lots of ideas. Since the eclipse will be happening around 1 in the afternoon, and we'll obviously be outside, picnic food makes sense to me. In terms of theme, anything round or crescent shape would work, but not everything needs to fit the eclipse theme visually speaking. We can think about the season and what packs easily and holds up well in a picnic basket. My basket will be filled with round crackers and slices of cheese. You could use round cookie cutters to make crescent-shaped slices of cheese if you like. Deviled eggs, sprinkled with edible spring flowers like violet and redbud. That would be nice. Maybe some sliced oranges. Croissants or crescent rolls would be good. You could make your favorite sandwiches and cut them into rounds. Ooh, what about pita bread? That's round. And hummus is an excellent picnic food. I also love to make a savory tart for picnics. Those can be round, and they taste great even after they've cooled. Savory hand pies would hold up well. We have an Earth Eats video showing all the steps for making delicious hand pies filled with greens, olives, and cheese. There's a little paprika in the pie dough. They're really good. And actually, I'm now thinking that that is probably what I am going to make for Monday. Someone in the office mentioned moon pies. Oreos would also be good. You could separate them and play around with the white and black. Do some little demonstrations about what you're about to see. If homemade is more your style, you're in luck because I've been working on an eclipse cookie idea of my own. I'll walk you through the steps from my home kitchen. This recipe is adapted from Susan Spungen's tahini marbled cookies from the New York Times, which we made in an Earth Eats video for the holidays a couple of years ago. You can find it on our YouTube channel. It involves a dough that's made with regular tahini and a dough that's made with black tahini, which is sometimes called black sesame paste. It's basically tahini that's made from black sesame seeds. It's not too difficult to find. I mean, it's not going to be at your neighborhood Kroger, but I did find some at World Foods Market in Bloomington, and I also think you can find it at B-Town International. Okay, so here goes.
Pretty straightforward recipe. Basically, we're making a cookie, it's kind of a shortbread type of cookie featuring tahini. So it really has a great flavor, this reminiscent of maybe a halva. And just if you love sesame, you love tahini, you are going to really love the taste of these. First thing we're going to do is assemble all of our ingredients. 3 cups of all-purpose flour, 1.5 teaspoons of kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder, 1 cup unsalted butter, that's 2 sticks, softened, 1 cup unsifted confectioner's sugar, 1 large egg, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, and 1/4 cup plain tahini, and 3 tablespoons of black tahini. You're not going to need as much of the black tahini because it's really intense. I think that's it. I have assembled all of my ingredients, and the butter has been softening in the bowl of my stand mixer. I'm going to go ahead and cream that together with the powdered sugar, also known as confectioner sugar. Confectioner sugar is added to the butter now. And as always, we have to scrape down the sides of our bowl. Okay, the mixture is light and fluffy, and now we're going to be adding the vanilla extract, 1 teaspoon, and 1 large egg. And I'm excited to get the chance to use this vanilla extract that was made by my friend Michael, who passed away late last year. This is something that was crafted by him that lives on and is going into these cookies. I know he would have been so excited about the eclipse this year. One large egg. In a separate bowl, mix together the all-purpose flour, the salt, and the baking powder. It's 3 cups of flour. One half teaspoon of baking powder. And 1.5 teaspoons of kosher salt. And I'm using diamond crystal kosher salt. I just want to whisk that together to combine it. And then we're going to add this flour mixture to the butter mixture and get that blended. Just blended, just till it kind of holds together as a ball. All right, that looks pretty good. I can really smell that tahini, which I haven't even added yet. It's because it's sitting over here open. Okay. Once you've mixed the basic dough together, it's going to be time to divide it. One part of the dough is going to get the white tahini, and one part of the dough is going to get the black tahini. Now, for the marbled cookie recipe, it was 2/3 white tahini and 1/3 black tahini because the black tahini is sort of the accent. But I'm a little concerned that that ratio isn't going to be quite right for this application. I'm wondering if it should just be half and half. So right now what we want to do is gather all of the dough together and form it into one ball. Probably going to have to use my hands. So I'm going to remove the dough from the bowl and put it out on the counter. And we're going to form it into sort of a fat log, is the way they described it, which I think makes sense. And then that just allows us to easily divide it in an even way. So I am not going to cut it exactly in half, but pretty close. And then the smaller portion is going to be the one that I add the black tahini to, and the larger portion is going to be the one that I add the white tahini. I'm going to take the smaller portion of dough and set it aside. I'm going to put the larger portion of dough, and it's only slightly larger, back into the bowl, and we're going to add the white tahini now. 1/4 cup. Oh my gosh, it totally smells like halva now. And now, once again, we are going to turn this out onto the countertop and form it into a disc and cover that and put it in the fridge for a bit. Now we're going to put the other piece of dough into the mixing bowl. And we're going to add the black tahini paste. Now I'm seeing right now, as I took the lid off, that the black tahini paste really needs to be mixed. I will warn you that this black tahini paste is a bit of a mess. So if at all possible, keep it contained in the jar. Once you get this blended, put it in the fridge so you don't have to do this again. This is definitely the hardest part of this recipe, is blending the sesame seed paste. Okay, finally, it's starting to look like it's getting blended. All right, I've got it mixed. It's looking smooth and well blended. And I think we're going to use 3 or 4 tablespoons. We definitely wanted to have that rich black color. inky black. That's what we want this to look like. There's three. So I think I'll do just a little shy of 4 tablespoons. We can see how it looks. If I don't think it's dark enough, I might add a little more. So honestly, this looks a little bit gray, which I'm not loving, so I'm going to add a little more of the tahini. I think it does change color a bit once you bake it. Okay, well, I have already added about as much black tahini to this dough as I think I can get away with. So we're just gonna have to see how it turns out. And now I have patted down both of the dough into a disc and covered them and put them in the fridge for a little bit just to kind of get them to chill so they're gonna be a little easier to roll out and make into our shapes. Our dough has chilled. We have our oven preheating. And now we're going to roll the dough out and shape it into our circles and our semicircles and eclipse-looking shapes. I'm going to start with the white tahini dough, the light-colored dough. Whenever you're rolling out dough of any kind, you want to keep kind of moving it around, make sure it's not ever sticking to your surface. All right, so I'm going to roll this out to about 1/4 inch, maybe just a little bit thinner than 1/4 inch. This is going to basically represent our sun, this lighter colored dough. And so it is just going to be rounds. And I have a biscuit cutter, which is about 2 or 3 inches. There's our timer, letting us know that the oven is preheated to 325. Once I have the circle shapes cut out, then I'm just placing them on a parchment-lined baking sheet. As you're transferring the circles, you're just going to want to be as careful as possible not to distort the shape. The firmer your dough is, the easier that'll be, so make sure you do chill the dough thoroughly before you go to shaping them. I am noticing that this is a pretty easy dough to handle, especially once you have it nice and chilled. And now it's time to roll out the black tahini cookie dough, and I'm happy to report it is looking sufficiently dark. And this is a dough that freezes well, so you could make the dough ahead of time, try out a few just to make sure you know what you're doing making them, and then save it until the day of the eclipse, and then you can make them that morning and enjoy them on the actual day of the eclipse. For the top layer with the black tahini dough, I'm making it even thinner, so more like 1/8 inch thick. And now it's time to cut the circles, and these are just going to be partial circles. I'm going to do different variations on a circle with a little bite cut out of it, a circle that is complete and will completely cover it to represent the totality, but then just like the different stages of the eclipse and how it looks when the sun is being eclipsed. So I'm basically going to start by cutting all circles. And these circles are just a little bit smaller than the one that I just cut with the white dough. So I've got the white tahini circle, full circle base, and then I'm going to make a simple buttercream, powdered sugar kind of icing. And I'm going to put that in between the two once they're both fully baked. I'm baking them separately, baking the white tahini circles, and then the black tahini partial circles are all going to be baked separately. And then once they're cooled, we can assemble them with the icing. And at that point, if I want to play around with sugaring, I can. And I'm going to set the timer for 9 minutes. I'll just check on them in 9 minutes and see how they're looking. All I wanted to do the tahini cookie because I like the idea of something that's inherently dark, something that's actually black, but maybe unexpected in its flavor. And the tahini is really going to work well for that. It's like a peanut butter cookie, but instead of peanut butter, you've got the sesame flavor. And so it's really nice. I think it's interesting, it's unexpected, and just like the eclipse itself, a bit of a wonder. Okay, the second batch is out of the oven. It looks pretty good. I'm going to assemble them into sandwich cookies and see how that works out. I will say overall, these cookies are pretty fragile. And I think that's because of how much tahini is in there. It's not, there's just one egg in the whole thing. It's not really binding it that well. So for my sandwich cookies, I'm just going to whip up a really simple icing. I'm not even measuring. I've got a couple tablespoons of butter that's softened. I've got some powdered sugar. Dumping that in there. It always takes a little more than you think it's going to. And then a little bit of vanilla for flavor. I'm just going to mix this up. If it needs a little more liquid, I'll just add a teeny bit of milk or water to that. I'm just going to mix that up till it's a good consistency for spreading, and then I'm going to assemble the sandwich cookies. Okay, so I got them iced. I put one thin layer of icing on the white tahini cookie, and then I placed the black tahini cookie on top. And then I took my sanding sugar, the sparkly glitter kind, and I sprinkled that on the exposed icing part on the cookie, and it looks really good. I like the way it turned out, and all right, let's give them a taste. Okay, well, that cookie really crumbles in your mouth. They have a very soft, sandy texture. And they are heavy on the tahini. I like them. If you want to try something different and impress your friends with black tahini cookies, these are the ones to make. In the final version of this recipe, and the one I liked best, I added a bit of freshly squeezed lemon juice and some lemon zest to the buttercream. It adds a lot to the overall finished cookie. Just that little acidic bite is really nice. I'm happy with how these turned out, and we have the recipe posted on our website. You could also take this theme and try it with different flavors. So if sesame isn't your thing, you could make simple round sugar cookies and then find a recipe for thin chocolate wafers and use those for the moon. Then you could assemble them with the buttercream as described here. Either way, I'd love to hear from you about your eclipse-themed foods. You can send me a message through Instagram or Facebook at Earth Eats, or find our contact info on our website, eartheats.org. That is also where you will find the recipe for these cookies and hundreds more. eartheats.org. It's time for a quick break, and then we'll hear from Daniela Richardson, who has a review of the FX series, The Bear. Stay with us. Kate Young here. This is Earth Eats. Daniela Richardson is a producer on our show. We've been talking lately about how cooking and kitchen culture show up in pop culture. And Daniela was thinking about how the competitive cooking shows can be limited in what they present and explore about our relationships with food. She decided to take a look at another presentation of the power of food through the FX television series, The Bear. Here's Daniela.
Warning. If you have not watched The Bear, both seasons 1 and 2, and you care about spoilers, you should probably cover your ears for this segment.
Yo, 25 pounds?
25, no, I ordered 200.
Paid for 25. Take it up a loop.
Media portrayals of kitchen culture tend to focus on sheer intensity, with plenty of $5 swear jar words and a cutthroat pace. We see this play out in popular reality cooking shows like Hell's Kitchen, and now in critically acclaimed comedy dramas like The Bear. The finely seasoned dramedy places Carmen Carmi Bearzado and his late brother Michael's failing restaurant with a resistant crew, insurmountable debt, and a struggle to wade himself through grief and back to his love for food.
Yeah. No, Luin, that's really nice of you. Yeah, no, we're really grateful to still be open after everything. Yeah, so listen, I'm still trying to figure this place out. You know, see how Michael was doing everything, and I want to get you your money. Yeah, I miss him too.
The healing and uniting powers of cooking and food have long been explored through media. Think movies like Eat, Pray, Love, Chef, or even Disney's Ratatouille. Like all of these films, The Bear pinpoints tough and relatable themes of family trauma and places it within a more digestible lens of main entrees and dessert. And yes, pun intended. Now, a recipe requires patience and effort. In most cases, you must follow the steps exactly as written. No skips allowed, and definitely no shortcuts. It's a journey, an arc with many twists and turns, and always a finale. Like a recipe, The Bear's main cast offers us a glimpse into parts of themselves that require patience and effort to understand. We get to witness these characters develop as individuals as they also develop as chefs. Perhaps the character who embodies this change the most is Richie Cousin Jeremovich.
Yo, you ever think about purpose?
I love you, but I do not have time for this, right? I have time for this. Purpose.
What's my purpose, homie? Yo, I'm trying really hard to be on board, cousin. I'm reading a lot. I'm trying to learn about who am I to my history. So in one of these books, there's this dude who's got, like, no skills, no personality, nothing. All he does is watch his trains.
Watch his trains do what?
Watches him be trained. And he's got this group of friends that he's had since he's a little kid. And they're outgrowing him. Like, one's like a sick athlete, one's a genius, this other one's nasty on the keys. And one day, out of the blue, boom, they drop his ass. They just cut that motherfucker off.
Why do they do that?
Because he's got no purpose.
Okay, so what does he do?
I don't know. I haven't read that far. But I do know that, 45, I've been here a long time. You feel me? I'm afraid one day I'm gonna wake up and you guys are all just gonna cut. Just drop this ass.
Richie, I'm not gonna drop this ass.
When we're first introduced to Richie, he comes off as loud, politically incorrect to a fault, and notably resistant to the new changes Carmi wants to bring to the beef. He also butts heads with the new sous chef Sydney, even finding himself quite literally stabbed in the back at one point. However, while we're met with his rough edges at first, we're slowly introduced to the additional layers of Richie that make him who he is. A father, a friend, and surprisingly, a visionary with many formidable goals. In season 2 of The Bear, we are transported back in time with episode 6, Fishes. The Bearzado family and friends gather at Carmi's mother's house for Christmas while she undertakes the arduous task of cooking a traditional Italian feast of the seven fishes. Among those in attendance are Richie and his then-pregnant wife, Tiffany. Here we gain an understanding that Richie's longing for purpose began long before Comrie took hold of the restaurant. In the past, his primary purpose was to be an upstanding father and a provisional husband. To do so, he believes his best options lie outside of food and customer service. We see this with his pleading to Carmi's uncle Cicero to give him a chance and offer him a job. He says he wants to do much more with his life than just wrapping sandwiches.
I'm about to have this kid. I don't want to be wrapping up sandwiches for the rest of my life. You know, I don't want to be coming home with my hands covered in grease trying to change diapers and stuff. You're someone with a lot going on. You could probably use some help. I've been looking. There's not much going on out there. You're somebody that knows something. And
Bill Murray? Bill Murray says that to Bill Murray because he's funny? And Bill Murray says, no, no. That's not funny. Give me your phone.
I don't want to be at the Beef every day. That makes sense, right? I feel like I'm wasting potential.
What kind of potential?
I don't know. But, I'm good with people. I don't really have an outlet for that, though. And I've never had a mentor. I've never had an uncle.
And I am neither of those things.
Yeah, but you understand what I'm saying, though, right?
No, I do not.
I'm not asking you for money. I want to learn. If you teach me, I will learn. And you can trust me.
We then experience a 180 within the following episode, Forks. There we witness present-day Richie on a journey to become who he wants to be. Now divorced, lacking his lifelong best friend Michael, and begging for a meaningful reason to keep going, Richie is sent, against his will, mind you, by Carmi to intern at a high-end Chicago restaurant. This is a practice known in the industry as stodging. For his 1 week stint there, the majority of his time is spent with 5 a.m. wake-up calls, military-esque meetings, and polishing forks. However, further in the week, Richie is given the chance to actively participate in the guest experience and see in real time why the little details of his actions matter. Said best by a member of the restaurant's crew during one of the aforementioned military-esque meetings.
Last thing, still, no one is owning up to the smudge. I want to clarify that it's not so much the smudge, but rather the fact that no one is taking responsibility for the smudge. We're not children. It's okay to make mistakes. We can smudge things, but we need to own up to them with immediacy, integrity, and honesty.
Through this experience, Richie applied his same attitude when previously asking Cicero for a job.
I want to learn. If you teach me, I will learn, and you can trust me.
We see him develop significantly from a man strongly resistant to change to someone wanting to know how to change. He takes the time to ask those he's shadowing questions, pays attention to the customer's desires, and actively takes control of changing his life. He shifts to a place where he has respect for not only the restaurant, but also for himself. This comes from his newfound connection to the part of food service that is arguably the second most important aspect, coming second only to the food itself. And that is acts of service and the guest experience. A realization that brings us to the conclusion that while Richie believed his purpose existed outside of the culinary industry, it had been there all along. He just needed direction to find his place within it. Richie's story of personal and professional development is just one of many that we get to see unfold across the two seasons thus far. This is one of the aspects of The Bear that sets it apart from reality cooking shows like Hell's Kitchen. While I thoroughly enjoy a good Gordon Ramsay scalding, I also enjoy what The Bear provides. A deeper understanding and window into the rewards and challenges that come from working in the food industry. When watching Hell's Kitchen as a viewer with zero experience in that world, all I can feel and think about is the intensity of the environment and how personally unthinkable a career in this industry would be for me. However, shows like The Bear illustrate what happens after the chefs hang up their hats and how the principles they carry with them in the kitchen can apply to all aspects of their lives. Like Richie must have enough respect to polish all the streaks from the forks, he must have enough respect to clean off the counter in his own kitchen at home. If you have not watched The Bear yet and made it to the end of this review, I would recommend you give it a try. It conveys exactly why food is a part of our hierarchy of needs. Beyond basic nutrition, food feeds our emotions, our memories, our relationships, and if you find that you yourself are like Richie, it can become the fuel for your inspiration.
Hey, Chi-Chi, it's Carm. You still got that Meat Connect?
That review of the series The Bear on FX comes from Earth Eats producer Daniela Richardson. And that does it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. The Earth Eats team includes Aya Bond Binder, Alexis Carvajal, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Toby Foster, Daniela Richardson, Samantha Schemenauer, Peyton Whaley, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Fernando Carvajal and Rachel Carvajal. Earth Eats is produced and edited by me, Kate Young. Our theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Additional music on the show comes to us from Universal Production Music. Our executive producer is Eric Bolstridge. Thank you.